Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret today. And coming up, the West Nile virus is in Wisconsin, and we'll get the latest from the state health department. Plus, the polio virus is back in the United States. But now, despite the long history of cinema and the many movies we have access to these days, it can still be difficult to pick out a good one, or a great one for that matter, if the pressure's on. But there are some reliable favorites, classics, that have been tested by time and countless viewers. Jocelyn Sepeniak-Galise is Associate Professor of English and Film Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. She wrote the book, The Optical Vacuum, Spectatorship and Modernized American Theater Architecture. She spoke to Rob Ferret about classic movies last year, and here's their conversation.
Now, Jocelyn, what does a classic mean to you? And maybe you have a personal answer and a film professor answer. I don't know.
I always have both film studies professor answers and personal answers, Rob. I think we can think about classics in a couple ways. The standard way of thinking about it would be to say, well, a film that's a classic is kind of like a pinnacle of the form, right? It embodies everything that had kind of led up until that moment, and it represents a kind of culmination. So we might think of a lot of classic American films as from the era of classical Hollywood cinema, from, you know, about the time that sound enters the picture, as it were, at the end of the 1920s, beginning of the 30s, till around the end of the Paramount decrees and when the studios break up, which kind of goes on until the end of the 1950s. So I think about classical films, but then also classics, right? Classics might not only be those that represent some kind of urtext of the form, they might also be films that have just sort of withstood the test of time and that we still really, really love.
Sometimes you see the blurb on the new movie, instant classic. Is there such a thing, or does some time have to pass before a movie can become a classic?
I think some time has to pass. I mean, that's kind of like saying, you know, this new film is a cult classic. I don't think the distributor gets to decide what's a cult movie.
Well, we've got one clip of one that you've actually talked to us before, I believe, one of your classic favorites. Let's start with this one, Singin' in the Rain, 1952 musical. Let's take a little listen.
Come on now, snap out of it. You can't let a little thing like this get you down. Why, you're Donald Lockwood, aren't you? And Donald Lockwood's an actor, isn't he? Well, what's the first thing an actor learns? The show must go on. Come rain, come shine, come snow, come sleet, the show must go on. So, Reedy, Pagliacci, Reedy.
Reedy, huh?
Yeah. Don, the world is so full of a number of things. I'm sure we should all be as happy as... But are we? No. Definitely no. Positively no. Decidedly no.
Why does that one stand out as a classic for you?
Oh, wow. This is probably the movie that I have watched the most number of times of any movie that I've ever seen. And right there, we heard Donald O'Connor as Cosmo and Gene Kelly as Don Lockwood. And I think Singin' in the Rain is just such an absolute classic movie for several reasons. First of all, it is a movie that comes out toward the end of the classical Hollywood era. So it really represents just the perfection, like the absolute craftsmanship that Hollywood was really capable of achieving at that moment in time. It is a Technicolor extravaganza. It's an MGM musical. It is lavish. It has stars we love, like Gene Kelly, but also Debbie Reynolds and Gene Hagen and Sid Charisse. But the other thing to me that makes it such a classic is that it doesn't just deal in what might be happening in 1952. It's actually a movie that's about Hollywood's transition to sound. It all takes place at the end of the 1920s. So we have this wonderful nostalgic description, this nostalgic visual and oral description of what Hollywood was like in the late 1920s. So it's kind of Hollywood playing itself. And that makes it both outrageously fun and something that encourages us to think about how film changes over time. Plus, who doesn't love Gene Kelly's dancing? It's just a thing of beauty.
We're talking about classic movies with Jocelyn Sepeniak-Galise from UW-Milwaukee. Lots of callers waiting, Jocelyn. I want to check out another one that I didn't know about, a Czechoslovakian film, Markéta Lazarová, made in 1967. What is that about? Why is it a classic?
Well, we can't just think that only American movies are classics, right? And this is another one of my very favorite films. This is, as you noted, a 1967 film from the former Czechoslovakia. And it's made in the kind of high moment of the Czech New Wave, which is when all of these kinds of new possibilities were opening up for Czech artists. It's partially because there's this moment, you know, of the Prague Spring in the end of the 1960s, when Soviet forces draw back a bit and there's less censorship in former Czechoslovakia. And this film is just a wonderful example of all of the cinematic possibilities that were just kind of blossoming in that moment. It is a beautiful film that takes place in the Middle Ages, but it's about the clash between the pagan and the Christian. But it's not done in your normal kind of like historical drama mode. Instead, it's all about trying to depict what the experience of living in that moment in time might have been like. So it works on so many different levels. It is an awesome action movie. It is filled with action. It's so exciting, but it's also really indicative of what kinds of forms of cinema were really possible at this moment in the 1960s. And it's also about the long history of the Czech people. It is just an absolutely spectacular film. And I wanted to bring that up because I was hoping a lot of listeners might get interested in it and watch it.
That's Markéta Lazarová from 1967, a Czech film. Let's go to your calls now. Kay starts us off in Madison. Kay, hello.
Hi. I seldom buy a movie, but I love Casablanca.
What is it that makes Casablanca a classic to you, Kay?
Well, it's a beautiful love story, but I love the black and white photography.
All right, Kay. I think a lot of people would say Casablanca. I'm more a Maltese Falcon kind of guy. Jocelyn, what do you think?
I mean, I do love Bogey, but my favorite is In a Lonely Place of his films. But got to go with Casablanca all the time, too.
Thanks a lot for that call, Kay. And are there movies like that, Casablanca, that you think a lot of people are just going to have on their classic list, Jocelyn?
Sure. I think Citizen Kane is one that many, many folks will turn to. And I think that's a good example of how the notion of a classic changes over time, because Citizen Kane wasn't necessarily celebrated when it came out. It was kind of weird. It was sort of out there. And it's only as time has gone on that that has become a real classic film.
As time goes by. Got it. Dennis joins us next in Racine. Dennis, hi.
Yes, I recommend absolutely seeing Gone with the Wind. That's a classic of that era. That's an absolute classic with Gable at his absolute best.
Dennis, thanks a lot for the call. And I think adjusted for inflation, anyway, one of the top grossing movies of all time. Some views have changed on that movie in hindsight, though. Jocelyn, can you talk about Gone with the Wind as a classic?
Sure. Yeah, that's also a really interesting film that I saw that with my grandma in the theater, actually, in not when it first came out, not in 1939. I just want to clarify that. But in a repertory theater in the 1990s, and it was still really epic and sweeping. It's interesting for so many reasons, but one of the things that we think about right now is certainly its depiction of the antebellum South. And I want to recommend the work of Jacqueline Stewart, who's introducing that film for HBO now. She's done a lot of work with TCM as well. And she's a really incredible historian who talks about how our understanding of that film has really changed over time.
Thanks a lot for that call. We'll go to Daniel next in Plover. Daniel, hi.
Hi, thanks very much for taking my call. I would say To Have and Have Not is my favorite film. It's the same story as Casablanca, just told in the Caribbean instead of North Africa. And it's just full of so many good lines. And the chemistry between Bogey and Bacall is really remarkable. And it's just a fun movie.
To Have and Have Not, and I'll say I have not seen that one, Jocelyn.
You're missing out. A classic Howard Hawks film, and also from the moment of classical Hollywood cinema. Ugh, Bacall. Love Bacall.
Daniel, thanks for the call. That reminds me, Jocelyn, I mean, we could spend a lot of time talking about all the movies I should have seen that I haven't seen. What are your thoughts on movie missing out shame?
Oh, yeah, we should have an acronym for that, but I'm not going to come up with it right now. I think a lot of us experience that. And when I was in graduate school doing my PhD in film and media studies, a lot of fellow graduate students would sit around together and talk about the most shameful films we were missing from our spectatorial experience. So I think everybody has that kind of a feeling.
Yes, movie Missing Out, shame. We're listening back to a conversation with Jocelyn Sepetiak-Galis, Associate Professor of English and Film Studies at UW-Milwaukee. She joined us to talk about classic movies, what makes them classic, and which ones you should add to your list. Coming up, we'll get more recommendations, and we'll pick up the conversation next on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, and right now we're picking up the conversation about great film classics. And our guest is Jocelyn Sepetiak-Galis, Associate Professor of English and Film Studies at UW-Milwaukee. She wrote the book, The Optical Vacuum, Spectatorship and Modernized American Theater Architecture. Here's the rest of her talk with Rob Ferret from last year. Central Time listener George in Delavan kicks off this conversation.
Yeah, I'm coming from the standpoint of with kids and grandkids. So Matilda, to watch with the grandkids, and we always watch Princess Bride with my own children.
George, thanks a lot for that call. And that's another take on a classic movie, Jocelyn. Maybe that movie you're looking forward to sharing with another generation.
Yeah, I think that's such a good way to think about it, most definitely. And The Princess Bride is a great one to share with all sorts of family members. I think that's one that a lot of people like to show to the newer generations.
Thanks for that call. We'll go next to Rob with us in Green Bay. Rob, hi.
Hi. Going back to a little bit older version, I put my vote in for Alfred Hitchcock's North by Northwest.
Oh, and I bet, Rob, are there other Hitchcock movies that you would put on your list, or is that the standout one for you?
Well, definitely Rear Window and others are great, Psycho, obviously. But I really like North by Northwest as kind of the precursor to the action-adventure suspense film, where they start, it's a mistaken identity situation, and they start in New York, and they end up going cross-country through Chicago and all the way out to Mount Rushmore, and just really some neat technical shooting by Hitchcock in that movie. And the suspense thriller, that the dialogue, especially between Cary Grant and Marie Saint on the train, is so snappy and before its time. There's just a lot of great aspects to it.
Fantastic, Rob. Thanks for that. Jostle a little Hitchcock there.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think really on the nose in terms of the technical mastery of that film, too, especially that very famous crop duster sequence where Cary Grant gets chased by the crop duster airplane in the fields. But of course, he and the crop duster, they were never actually in the same shot together. It's just the magic of special effects and rear projection. It's absolutely masterful.
Thanks for the call. Ted joins us now in Lone Rock. Ted, hi.
Hi, I wanted to contribute two titles to your discussion. One is Failsafe by Sidney Lumet. It's got a whole host of wonderful actors in it. Henry Fonda, Walter Matthau, Larry Hagman, and an incredible performance, dramatic performance, small featured role by Dom DeLuise, a great comedian. This is a serious role for him. But I remember seeing it. I'm close to 70 years old right now, and I remember seeing it when it came out, probably in the 60s, I'm guessing. And it deals with the arms race, the Cold War. And it is the be-all and end-all of nuclear proliferation and how dangerous it is. And the other film that I was a kid seeing was called Shoes of the Fisherman, and that stars Anthony Quinn. And it is this incredible story about a man. This was before we had our first non-Italian pope. Anthony Quinn becomes pope, but it's got a fairy tale ending. The world is in chaos. World War III is about to happen. And the Catholic Church, through Anthony Quinn's portrayal of the pope, solves it by saying he will give up all the riches of the church to feed the hungry. So there won't be a World War III.
Ted, thanks a lot for the call. Well, there's ones that stood the test of time for Ted. He's remembering seeing these as a youth in the 60s, and they are still front of mind for him, clearly, Jocelyn.
Yeah, I mean, that really hits me on a personal level because Failsafe was one of my dad's favorite films. Oh. And so I watched that with my dad when I was a kid. He was a big peace activist in the 60s. So that one holds some particular resonance for me that I don't think I can even have real critical thinking about that one because I associate it so deeply with my father.
Thank you so much for sharing those with us, Ted. Cheryl is with us now in Eau Claire. Cheryl, hi.
Hi there. It wouldn't be Christmas without White Christmas, first part of the season. I like that.
Every year for you, Cheryl?
Yep. Starts the Christmas off.
All right. Cheryl, thanks a lot for the call. White Christmas, Jocelyn.
Oh, yeah. I think we talked about that movie the last time I was on.
We did indeed. Yeah.
Yeah. Great example of using the magic of color film.
Thanks for that call. We are talking about classic movies. Jocelyn Sapaniak-Gillies is with us from UW-Milwaukee. Jocelyn, before we get back to our callers, one more film you wanted to share with us, a little more recent, 1989, My 20th Century, a Hungarian movie.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I have to be true to myself, which is bringing up the esoterica as much as possible. this is a film I absolutely adore. It's by this filmmaker, Ildikó Anyeti. I have no idea if I'm pronouncing that correctly, but I'm not Hungarian, so forgive me. And it's a really fine film that takes on these two twin sisters who are separated, and then they have these two different life experiences. But they're coming of age at the turn of the 20th century. And it's really a film that's about a love letter to cinema. It's about how cinema has ended up inflecting all of our experiences in the 20th century. Of course, this is made toward the end of the 20th century. It's really looking back at almost 100 years of film production and thinking about what that's meant for culture and what that's meant for our shared dreams and our shared imagination. It is an absolutely beautiful, magical film. And I really wanted to bring that one up because it never was available in the United States. You had to go through a lot of different channels to try to see it for a long time. But just recently, Kino Lorber has restored it. And as of about a month ago, you can see it on just about any streaming platform. So I think that's a really great example of an older film that is having new life. And I just really want everybody to enjoy it as much as I do.
That's My 20th Century from Hungary. Let's go back to your calls now. Brian is with us in Benton. Brian, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What do you got for us, Brian?
It's called Captain Fantastic. Viggo Mortensen starred in it. It's a great movie about the bonds of family and the loss of a loved one due to mental illness.
Interesting. And that's a more recent one, I think. I'm looking it up, 2016. So a recent Captain Fantastic, Jocelyn, I have not seen that. Have you seen that? Or are there any more recent ones that leapt to classic status for you in that way?
Yeah, you know, I haven't seen that one either, but I do want to bring up Viggo Mortensen because I think that he's the reason maybe, I'll speculate given that I haven't seen the film. I think he might be the reason in large part that maybe somebody might think about this one as a classic because he has that real gravitas that older film stars really did, right? He's really somebody that we might place in an older film. So I think depending on who the actor is, that also might lend classic status to a film.
Thanks for that call. Time for at least one more call, or maybe two. Andy is on the line in Milwaukee. Andy, hi.
Hello. I've got about 100 movies that I could name, but the one that I never miss is the Preston Sturges classic, Sullivan's Travels. I think it was 1940. Brilliant movie. It's got comedy. It's got all the seriousness you could want, and it's just a great movie.
Sullivan's Travels. Travels, yes. I just looked it up. 1941, it looks like, Jocelyn.
Oh, my gosh. I mean, anything Preston Sturges, just an absolutely brilliant writer and director. Even when he wasn't directing really fine films like Sullivan's Travels, which is just, it's just sparkling. It is delightful. But he also wrote a lot of screenplays before turning to directing as well. And if you think you don't like older comedies, then I think watch some Preston Sturges. He is just, he's so funny.
We've gotten so many emails. We'll get to them all. Pete in Reedsburg says, it's all about Eve. A young person's cultural education wouldn't be complete until they've seen a certain Betty Davis movie. All About Eve, Jocelyn.
I just totally agree. I love All About Eve so much. I made my students watch it in my classical Hollywood class just a couple years ago. For me, it's Betty Davis all the way. I mean, I just love her so much. And It is kind of a classic story of competition. It's catty, it's campy, it's backstabbing, it's got everything. It's wonderful.
And Jocelyn, in our last half a minute or so, one thing that's hard to do these days is see a movie in a theater, much less classic movies in theaters. D- Do they still, a lot of them, hold up as well on the home screen?
You know, some of them do. I think it's always the best to see a film where it was meant to be shown, which is usually the big screen. But maybe you're like me, and during this pandemic, you took the opportunity to get a giant television. That could help a little bit with your spectatorial experience. I think a really good film, a really classic film, is still going to be a thrilling and fulfilling experience no matter where you watch it.
Jocelyn, it's been a lot of fun and it flew by. Thanks a lot for joining us again.
It did. Thanks so much for having me on.
That was Jocelyn Sapaniak-Galise, Associate Professor of English and Film Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, also author of the book, The Optical Vacuum, Spectatorship in Modernized American Theater Architecture. She talked to Rob Ferret about classic movies last year. And you can keep the conversation going with a movie or movies you think everyone needs to see at least once in their life. So what's your pick? And what did that movie mean to you? Did it teach you anything? Tell us what you loved about it by emailing us, ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org, and we may share it on the air. So you tell us what movies we should be seeing. At least two animals now in Wisconsin have contracted the West Nile virus. The mosquito-borne disease is transmissible to humans, but even if you do contract it, you're unlikely to develop symptoms. Rebecca Osborne's a vector-borne disease epidemiologist at the Wisconsin Department of Health Services. And Rebecca, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
How dangerous is the West Nile to humans?
Well, like you mentioned, the large majority of people that are infected with the virus will probably not even realize that they've been infected because it often doesn't cause any symptoms. But for about one in every 150 people that becomes infected will go on to develop what we call West Nile encephalitis or severe disease and might end up in the hospital. So it can be very serious in a certain proportion of people.
What about our pets, Rebecca?
Yeah, good question. So the animals that are most affected by West Nile virus include horses. So people who do own horses are probably familiar with a vaccine that's available to prevent West Nile virus disease in their horses. Otherwise, it generally infects wild birds, which is how the virus ends up being transmitted to mosquitoes in the first place.
Can it only be transmitted from mosquitoes? I mean, could there be an infected animal transmitting it to another animal or even, say, a human?
So it's only a spread from birds to mosquitoes.
Okay.
So that's how mosquitoes become infected in the first place. That mosquito could then go on to bite a person or a horse, for example, and make that animal sick. But a person who gets West Nile virus can't do a very good job of infecting a mosquito. So really it's the birds that are giving the virus to the mosquitoes, and that mosquito might go on and bite someone else, like a horse or a human.
Rebecca Osborne joining us from the Wisconsin Department of Health Services, vector-borne disease epidemiologist. And I feel like it hasn't been a really bad mosquito season, at least here in South Central Wisconsin. And I also feel like, well, fall's encroaching on us and maybe mosquito season is in our back rearview mirror. As a vector-borne disease epidemiologist, how do you see the news of West Nile virus found in two animals in Wisconsin?
Yeah, this is the time of year when people sort of have their sights set on fall.
Right.
School is starting, you know, the weather's sort of hinting at a change, but this is still sort of peak West Nile virus season through the end of the month, generally, depending on weather. So really, August and September are the time of the year when we see the most number of West Nile virus cases in both animals and people.
Huh.
It's been a quiet year so far, right? We just had a couple animals that have been reported, but we know it's out there. We know it's in the mosquitoes. Probably some people are being exposed that may not be getting sick, but unfortunately, it's probably just a matter of time before we start seeing a few human cases pop up.
Do we know?
So
do we know?
Continue to think about it until it's sort of a really cold frost, and then we can forget about mosquitoes for the year.
All right, so the frost is what we're waiting for, but why is the risk of getting this West Nile virus the highest at the end of summer, Rebecca?
Yeah, so that's a great question with a really complex answer, but there's a lot of different things that can affect how risky it is to get West Nile virus. But one of the main things that can contribute to risk in people is a really high temperature. This can affect how quickly the virus replicates or sort of becomes transmissible in the mosquito. And it can even, change the mosquito's behavior and how often they take blood meals or bite a person. So August and September, on average, are really hot months for Wisconsin, and even in the end of July. So that really is affecting the number of infected mosquitoes that are flying around outside. That's why the risk is highest this time of year.
What are you doing to prevent mosquito bites? What can we do to stave off a West Nile virus spread?
Sure. So one of the best things to do is to just think about preventing bites when you go outside. The time that these mosquitoes that spread West Nile virus are most active is at dawn and dusk. So this is going to be the most important times of day to protect yourself. And that would be, wearing a mosquito repellent. My favorite is a product that includes picaridin, which is a kind of EPA or Environmental Protection Agency registered repellent. There's other common ones like DEET, but there are several options that work really well against mosquito bites. The other thing to do is just cover up your skin. So if you can bear it, even if it's really hot, wear sort of long sleeve, loose fitting clothing that can keep the mosquitoes from getting to your skin. And then just again, avoiding those peak biting times at dawn and dusk.
Yeah, I usually use the DEET. So I wanted to ask you again, Rebecca, about the insect repellent that you use. What's it called?
My favorite is called picaridin. It's an active ingredient that's found in a variety of different products.
Thank you.
There are others. You can check on the EPA website if you just look for repellents. They have a great website that has a lot of options that are, again, registered with the Environmental Protection Agency.
Rebecca Osborne from the Wisconsin Department of Health Services taking a look at the West Nile virus, which has been found in two animals in Wisconsin. And what do West Nile virus symptoms look like, Rebecca? In humans who show symptoms, what could we expect?
Yeah, so in a lot of people, it might cause a mild flu-like illness, a flu for a few days. So body aches, chills, fever, headache, muscle pains. And a lot of people will just get that.
We're kind of cutting out there. So just to reiterate here, Rebecca says it would be flu-like symptoms. And if you do have those symptoms, you should consult a physician immediately. And that would be the symptoms to look for. And Rebecca, do we have you back?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I'm sorry about that. So I was just saying some of the symptoms to look for in humans, it would be like a flu-like symptoms. And what to do if you were to come down with those symptoms, I would imagine wouldn't be different than any other time you'd have those symptoms.
Yeah, certainly contact your healthcare provider if you start to feel really sick and aren't feeling better after a few days. And if you have more serious symptoms like, confusion and memory loss and balance issues, things that are really concerning for the more severe presentation of West Nile virus, certainly call your doctor right away.
But it would, like so many things in our health system, prevention would be the best medicine in this regard.
Absolutely. Yep. So just taking a few steps to prevent bites is excellent, as well as trying to keep standing water away from your home. One other thing to think about, mosquitoes love to breed in water. So tip those containers, clean out your buckets and drains and make sure there's not a lot of standing water around your house.
Well, Rebecca Osborne, you give us a reason to look forward to our first frost.
That is one reason to look forward to winter, is the saying goodbye to mosquitoes.
Thank you for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you again.
Rebecca Osborne, vector-borne disease epidemiologist at the Wisconsin Department of Health Services, talking with us about what you need to know about the West Nile virus in Wisconsin. Now, it's time for Wisconsin Life, and here's producer Mary Kate McCoy with a story about the healing power of nature.
Sometimes, an ordinary experience surprises us, turning the mundane into something extraordinary. Writer Crystal Chan felt this on a walk she took in her neighborhood with a friend, reminding them of the power of being present and enjoying the moment.
It was supposed to be a typical evening walk. My friend Zach was visiting from Manitowoc, and when I told him about the pond in our Oshkosh neighborhood, he wanted to see it. What I call the pond is a retention pond for an originally low-lying area in our neighborhood, The city created the pond in order to prevent people's basements from flooding. Mallard ducks congregated there in the summer, and as the autumn drew on, the ducks were replaced by geese. Zach and I walked to the pond at dusk. As we rounded the corner to the pond, we heard them. Geese. All spring and summer, I had seen only a couple geese at a time. Now, there were maybe 50, and they were flying, making wide circles around the pond, honk-talking to each other as they flew. As the last of the sky's color faded into night, the geese continued to make wide, low circles, honking, flapping powerfully mere feet over our heads. I thought that the geese were just going to circle low to the ground, and that would have been magic enough. But as night settled in full, we heard more honking far in the distance. More geese were coming. Zach and I watched on silently. The original flock of 50 geese were still circling above us. Then a single goose silently landed on the water and cried out, honking to the others. "Maybe that one is a scout," Zach whispered. And sure enough, within moments, the 50 bodies of muscle and wing skidded onto the surface of the water. Moments later, the second wave of honking was above us, another dark flock. The geese, already on the water, cried back in a cacophony of noise until the flying group also skid-landed on the surface. After that, a third flock circled in, honking, more skid-landing. 150 geese, then 200 of them. Only a thin strip of light shone from a parking lot lamp, a sliver of visibility. And in this sliver, we saw a density of powerful bodies on the pond. Beyond this thin sliver of illumination, darkness. But we knew that it was not just darkness. We knew there were hundreds of wild animals mere yards away. The power of their presence was tangible. It is not unsurprising that our experience rendered itself as utmost holiness in this COVID world. These days, presence is fleeting. We have all been presence-starved. You can't see this inner starvation, but it's there. As the night grew thick, I couldn't see Zach a couple feet away from me, but I could feel his presence. Just as I couldn't see the 200 powerful bodies upon the pond, but I could feel their presence. It was a visceral, primal sensing of presence, one that surpassed any Zoom meeting, one that fed the heart and spirit. At some point, the geese grew quiet and there was silence. In the thick darkness, Zach and I couldn't see them at all. But the power of their presence was overwhelming and palpable in the silence of that night. And in some deep and indescribable way, it healed a hungry, hidden part of us.
Writer Crystal Chan brought you that story about the healing power of nature. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org. I'm Mary Kate McCoy.
Polio, an incurable disease that affects mostly children, is circulating in New York State. After decades of presumed eradication in the United States, the World Health Organization has put us on the list of countries where polio is now circulating. One out of 200 polio infections cause irreversible paralysis, and 5 to 10% of children paralyzed by polio will die from the disease. Rosemary Rochford is a professor of immunology and microbiology at the University of Colorado School of Medicine, and she joins us next. Rosemary, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
What do we know about these confirmed polio cases in New York State? What are the details here?
We only have one case of polio of a young man who was not vaccinated and developed paralytic polio, so he's paralyzed due to the infection. But we've detected the virus itself in the wastewater in at least four counties so far.
four counties across New York. And so what does that mean from the view of immunology and microbiology? What does that portend?
What it portends is it means that there's a lot of people that are infected with this virus that are shedding it in their feces. They don't know they're infected, but they're still able to spread it. So in areas where there's very low vaccination rate, like in some counties, there's 60 to 70% people are vaccinated. That means 30% are not. They're going to be susceptible to getting infected with poliovirus if they get in contact with somebody who is infected but might not even know it.
So we don't have definitive numbers outside of the one known case that has been identified in New York State. What does that mean for dealing with an outbreak of polio, Rosemary?
What it means is we need to get as many people vaccinated as possible. When we used to have polio circulating in this country back in the 1950s and we'd have epidemics every year, we developed the vaccine in the 1950s and then another one in the 1960s and dropped the cases down in the 1970s. We had less than 10 cases in the U.S. and it was eliminated. So vaccines prevent this virus from spreading in this country. So that's really the only tool we have, and it's a great tool.
Rosemary Rochford, professor of immunology and microbiology at the University of Colorado School of Medicine. And how is this polio spread? How infectious is it?
It's very infectious. It's spread not by respiratory, like we think about with COVID right now. People can have it through their breathing, but it's through contamination with objects. So say you go to the bathroom, you don't wash your hands so well, right? And it can be lingering on your fingertips and you touch a glass and somebody else picks that up. So through contaminated objects is really one of the key ways, or person to person is another key way for it to be transmitted.
We just talked about the West Nile virus in Wisconsin, Rosemary, and how people who have contracted the West Nile virus may not know it. Many of them, most of them, would not even be symptomatic. How does that play out for polio? When people contract polio, the polio virus, do they know it?
Well, actually, there's a range of things, just like with any kind of infectious disease. Some people are infected and we call them asymptomatic. They have no symptoms, so they don't know. Some people might be infected and get kind of a stiff neck, kind of sort of flu-like symptoms, and then some people can go on to develop that paralysis. So there's a range of symptoms that people can experience. And sometimes they might confuse that kind of illness, not feeling so good, crummy kind of feeling with something else, but it could be due to polio.
And but the question would be, are you vaccinated against polio though, right? Because if you're vaccinated, I would imagine your concerns are diminished to none. If you are not, I would imagine this would be an opportunity for you to do so.
Yeah, it would be definitely an opportunity to do so. And in fact, I just had my sister was asking me if her kids were reaching out to her to say, have we been vaccinated? And in this country, most states require children to be vaccinated against polio when they go to public schools. But a lot of people have chosen not to vaccinate their children. And so now would be a good time to take advantage of that vaccination. It's a very, very safe vaccine.
So as I understand it, Rosemary, this is the first polio case that's originated in the United States since 1979. What does this say about where we are right now with the routine childhood vaccinations that you've been talking about today?
Well, I have to say, somebody who studied these viruses and tried to think about how to prevent them, to realize for the viruses, we do have tools to prevent them, that people aren't taking advantage of those tools. And also, you know, with COVID, a lot of people, haven't been out to the regular vaccines just because people were indoors for a while, not moving about. But there's really this anti-vaccine campaign spreading falsehoods about sort of what can happen has been a real challenge for public health officials to try to get people to say, these are important. And we've forgotten how serious it can be with polio, right? We don't have images for most of us of people, of children in wheelchairs or in iron lungs.
Yeah, it was such a big deal for most of the early part of the 20th century. As we look back on that time, what should we learn from that history that we should bring to the fore here today?
Well, I would say that public health is really important. We've forgotten the value of that. And I also want to really emphasize that you might not worry about contracting polio for yourself, but what if you're asymptomatic, so you don't know you're sick and you spread it? There's people that have that don't have any good immune system through children sometimes have missing parts of their immune system not working so well, and they're really susceptible. So you, when you get vaccinated with polio, you protect not only yourself, but you can protect your community. And we really need to have enough people in a community vaccinated to protect them.
We heard some of those same arguments when it came to the COVID vaccine, and yet we've still seen vaccine hesitancy, whether it be with COVID and now with some of the numbers we're seeing in an outbreak of polio, the polio virus in New York State. So from your perspective of immunology and microbiology, Rosemary Rochford, what can we do in this regard to beat back vaccine hesitancy or to argue on behalf of the efficacy of vaccines? What role do we play in the grand scheme of public health here?
I think I have a phrase that I was thinking about this when we were talking about with COVID and people were worried about it. And I said, to protect your community, you get your immunity. And I really, it's our, you know, as we think about being public minded and civic minded for our community, that's really one thing we can start helping people to do. And I also think, you know, those of us in immunology and microbiology, we're always happy to talk to people and understand people's concerns about vaccine. I think they're really, I appreciate that there can be concerns about that. And I think I don't want to dismiss those concerns, but I certainly would love to have the chance to address those concerns.
Rosemary Rochford, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
You're welcome. It's my pleasure.
And we're just out of time. Rosemary is a professor of immunology and microbiology at the University of Colorado School of Medicine, and she talked with us today about polio cases in New York State, about the lag in routine childhood vaccination in recent years. And if you've got more about this, you are always welcome to join the conversation and keep it going on the Ideas Network Facebook page. You can also email us ideas@WPR.org and let us know your thoughts, and those thoughts may make it to the air sometime tomorrow or in the near future. Also, speaking of which, coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll go in search of America's still missing workforce. We'll also be on the lookout for the best guides you'll find for parenting adult children and explain a new people's history of the GOP. Coming up next, news from NPR and WPR, and then the burgeoning new economy being built around college athletes. UW-Madison alums and donors have launched a collective to pay UW athletes and remain competitive. So who's paying? Who's benefiting? And what's this mean for the future of college sports? I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret today, and you're listening to Central Time.